Good morning, dear, or good afternoon, whenever you're hearing this, dear colleagues and friends. It's my pleasure to introduce Mrs. Rebecca McManaman to you. Rebecca is one of my direct colleagues at the University of Vienna. She has been working at the Department of European International and Comparative Law. She is part of the group of Professor Michael Weibel, who works in public international law in particular. And the interesting detail that made me invite Rebecca is that she is from New Zealand. That's already interesting per se, but interestingly, she also taught there already in New Zealand, and she taught a course on legal writing and legal research. And I thought that it would be very interesting to hear from someone from the other side of this planet, how people educate and how people learn there about legal research and legal writing. Rebecca, so pleased to have you here. Thank you very much for your time. How is it to live in Vienna as someone from quite far away?
Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be talking to your audience. It's very, very beautiful living here. It's, you know, New Zealand is great at nature and Europe is great at buildings.
Okay, that's very diplomatic.
Exactly. Incredible. Very, very beautiful.
Yeah. And when it comes to legal, your legal environment, the university environment, what is the most important difference on a daily basis in your daily perception?
I think probably the most important difference is just that the university here is a lot bigger. So my home university possibly has around 30 to 50 members of staff, and just our institute has around 30 members of staff. So the scale is very different. I think that my entire university had about 15,000 people, and apparently Juridicum, or the University of Vienna Law, has about 15,000 people.
Yeah.
So the scale is very different, but other than that, I'm reassured to find that in many ways things are the same.
Which are the ways that are the same? What is similar then?
I guess just people are interested in learning, people are interested in sharing ideas, people are curious, people are open to different ways of thinking, which is interesting for me because I come from quite a different legal way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So it's been a huge insight for me to understand really how civil lawyers think and what that reflects about my own legal culture and traditions, and that exists even in an international law space, even though I think people would say it doesn't, it does. It's been interesting to learn how to navigate that.
Yeah, so you mentioned now already that New Zealand doesn't have a civil law system. It's quite the opposite in a way. So how could you briefly describe the main differences?
Yes, of course. So it's a common law system, and New Zealand is also a place that was settled, colonized by the English. So we talk about having two different legal sources or legal system sources, which is one would be tikanga, which is customary law, Maori indigenous customary law, and the other one would be English common law, statute law. Through a whole process of devolution, New Zealand eventually became its own legal country and had its own legal system. And now we don't really have English law anymore either, although there are some English law, very, very strong English law roots, but there are also similarities with different parts of the Commonwealth on different topics. For example, New Zealand's property law is taken from Australia's, basically. New Zealand's human rights law is taken from Canada's. But there are parts of New Zealand law that pretty squarely remain very English, for example, intellectual property law. So we're weaving together these two systems, and we're at a point in our constitutional reckoning or building of a legal system where one of our Supreme Court judges has said we're at this point of a third law, which is a meaningful meeting of the first law of Indigenous peoples and the second law of the English settlers. And that's particularly interesting in New Zealand, and also, I mean, for legal research, for legal thinking, for legal argument. And if I can just give one example, there's been a recent climate change case, which my PhD is on climate litigation, so I'm very familiar with that kind of around the world. And one of these cases in New Zealand is a tort-based climate change case where the plaintiffs are arguing for the existence of a new tort, some kind of climate change tort. And they've said that includes some elements of this first law, some elements of tikanga, because of a different relationship that Indigenous people have with the environment. And it was struck out by the High Court, struck out by the Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court, maybe a month ago, has sent it to be heard, so it's sent to trial. So it's really this developing legal system, even though it's one of, even though we're one of the oldest democracies in the world.
And how do you teach this? I mean, Austin lawyers, as you know, are taught that one of the things they should constantly do is look into the code and learn about what the law says and start by interpreting the law and stick to the law as much as you can, which is probably quite different from how you would approach a problem, right?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I think civil lawyers, and perhaps even more Austrians coming from home of positivism, find it hard to understand that what we're doing is also looking for the law and interpreting the law.
Yeah. So the cliche is probably common, that this is a different discipline, right? So it's not really science, right?
Yes, I think we would think law is a bit more like an art. There's science and art, a bit of debate about that. But yeah. The other thing to kind of keep in mind is that New Zealand also has a lot of statute law. So in that way, we're also looking for what's in the code. It's not always codified, which is the problem. But New Zealand makes a lot of statute law compared to lots of other countries. And so then what we would think about is that in terms of legal research or legal teaching or the order in which laws come, I guess, boils down to that, is that Parliament is supreme and has the full authority to make laws. And then if Parliament hasn't made a law about it, perhaps there's some pre-existing common law, so court-made law about the topic, or perhaps courts are going to interpret the statutes. But and that's where you get kind of the doctrine of precedent becoming really important to uphold the value of legal certainty, which I know is a very strong constitutional value in Europe, and you achieve that by saying, well, here's what the code says. And by contrast, many common lawyers, I've got many friends working in London at the moment, working with civil lawyers, and they say, what's the law on this topic? And the civil lawyers say, well, here's the code. And then the common lawyers say, and that doesn't resolve the issue. How do I know how I'm going to reliably and certainly resolve this issue? So that's the difference, I think.
Yeah, and how, I mean, what are you doing now on a daily basis when you're talking to your Austrian or German and or Central European friends and colleagues coming from a very positivistic background, and then trying to find the answers in the code? And if they don't find it there, then looking around, right?
Yeah, so it's I think that interesting section of what happens if you don't find answer in the code, or what's permissible in terms of looking around. And the other interesting thing about New Zealand is that we don't have a written constitution, which blows most people's minds. They're like, but do you have one? You don't have one. And we say, no, we do still have one. It's just unwritten. But those two things combined means that when you're looking around, there's a lot more scope for argument about where the edges of that law are. And something that's very, I think, a strength of the common law and the common law method is that courts can amend what the law is to meet the changing circumstances, provided they do it in a legalistic way, right? They can't just make it up. They have to follow legal interpretation rules set out by statute. They have to follow the doctrine of precedent. But that means in terms of legal thinking and legal argument, you need to think a lot about what other cases exist, and of those cases, which bits of those cases are lawmaking, which bits maybe we would call them ratio, or which bits are obiter, and that they don't resolve the legal issue. I don't know if you have that distinction in Austrian law.
I think, yeah, some way we do.
And you spend a lot of time thinking about and arguing about and researching or thinking critically about the persuasiveness of a particular case and the materiality of that case. So something I realized at the end of my undergraduate law degree was that the main thing I had learned in New Zealand was how to think like a lawyer, and how to think like a lawyer in New Zealand required you to consider how similar or different things were. This is my joke. I've just become very good at seeing how similar or different things are to see whether or not the law can apply to those circumstances, or if the circumstances would mean the law needs to slowly, gradually, incrementally evolve, or not. Maybe it's not the role of the court to do that in the circumstances. So.
But similarity is somehow a question of perspective, obviously, right? So it very much depends on how you look at things in order to be able to decide whether it's similar or not. And do you learn?
I've honestly never thought about it like that. It feels very much like a learned instinct, which you learn from watching other people exercise legal judgment about what's sufficiently similar or not. But it probably is dependent on your perspective. I've never thought about it like that.
So then let me ask how you teach this. I mean, the overall teaching system might be a little bit more complicated perhaps than it is in a civil law country, because at least we know where we start with, right? And that might also be true if there is a statute, but if there is something where there is no statute, it will be probably rather challenging how to start educating people, teaching people about the content, because you can't simply tell them, look for the similar case, without telling them what similarity means in this. So how is this going?
Yeah, totally. So there's some really interesting things coming up in that question. And one of the things that it makes me think about is one of my friend's grandfathers was one of the first people to decide how law should be, or to rethink how law should be taught in New Zealand universities. And he went to the UK, where they do mainly a textbook style of law, a lot more like Austria teaches law. So there's lectures, there's textbooks. They may not be directly related. And then there's an assessment. And it's really like the material is given to the students to learn, remember, and come back and do an exam on. And that was in contrast to, so the friend's grandfather also went to the US and learned how they taught law there and preferred that style and brought that style back to New Zealand. And that style is more what they would call a casebook style. And it's teaching you inductive reasoning. So you're learning to derive the rule bottom up from specific cases. And the other way that it teaches you to think like a lawyer and learn to exercise that judgment yourself is that it gives you lots of what we would call like case studies or something, where you get a hypothetical case, which is different from the facts of the cases that you've learned about, or perhaps isn't clearly resolved by the statute. And then you discuss that with each other in quite a, most of the classes, particularly at the university that I went to, was most well known for this in New Zealand, but in some kind of Socratic style where it's question and answer between the teacher or the professor and members of the class, still in quite a big class. So there still might be 30 to 150 people in each of these classes, but it's very, you're learning to analyze through the process of being in class. So you're learning the skill in class rather than learning the content, if that makes sense. I mean, you're learning the content as well, but...
Yeah. So the requirement that this works is that students do a lot of homework and they do a lot of reading in particular in preparing for classes, right? So there is much more
preparation for classes. They have usually you'll have your name. You have a specific seat that you sit in the entire course, and you have your name written down on the seating chart. And then at some point in the course, perhaps multiple times, but at least once, you're going to be the person that it's relied on for this class discussion. And it's not just it's really quite critical discussion, so you do have to have done a lot of preparation, because if you just read the summary of the case, sure, you might be able to answer the first question of what are the facts of the case, what statutory context does it arise in, who were the parties, but you won't be able to answer the questions of, here's my hypothetical scenario where I've changed one thing about the case. Does the law still apply? Which is that materiality, or that, I think, sufficiently similar kind of judgment that we're trying to teach people how to exercise.
Mm-hmm. And people follow the rules, so it doesn't happen frequently that students simply answer, "Sorry, I didn't read it," or
not very often, because it's quite socially embarrassing to do so. Yeah. So sometimes they do, and usually the teachers will say, "Okay, sure, next person, the person after you." And if you've missed your opportunity to do that by the end of the course, then that's part of your grade.
Yeah.
So you have your own incentive to do it, both socially and academically. You can also say, "I don't know what the answer is." And the teacher, depending on how much time they have and how very much into the Socratic method they are, will say, "Well, have a think about it. Talk to your neighbor." Everybody talk to their neighbors for 2 minutes. And now give another go. Try again.
Okay. And what about the final exam then? Is this about solving a case, or is it answering theoretical questions? If there is a written exam at the end of the class, aren't there any?
No, there usually are written exams. So usually there would be one perhaps essay during the course of the semester, perhaps a small test in the course of the semester, so that you don't have too much content in the final exam. And the final exam would often be these so-called problem questions, where you have made up facts of a case, or maybe it's similar to one of the cases you learned. Probably it's very similar, and you're supposed to figure out how the law applies to that, given that you've already talked about it. So you're quite well equipped for the exams. So usually the exam would have a problem question. It might have some theoretical discussions saying this doctrine is under challenge by this circumstance. Discuss. Or it might have something saying the law of evidence has evolved to meet the requirements of, for example, victims of sexual harm needing protection from from the perpetrator of that crime. Discuss the ways in which this works or doesn't work, or discuss how this can be improved, or something which would require you to think not. And this is another important or an interesting point, where my experience of Austrian legal teaching and New Zealand legal teaching diverges. So that's obviously not a legal question, right? How could it be improved? Although you're expected to have a legal answer to how it could be improved. Mm-hmm. So the answer could be protecting suppression law, or the answer could be saying, well, the defendant's right to hear the case against them isn't eroded by the complainant sitting in another room. So it's not just this imaginary, like, how should we make everything better for everybody? It's still quite legalistic, but that is a difference that I find in Austria versus New Zealand, is that we're willing to say that those questions are within the scope of appropriate legal study. But in Austria, I think they're less likely to say that.
Well, it very much depends on in which class you are sitting, obviously. But if you are sitting in one of the dogmatische, as they are called, the dogmatic subjects, in particular in private law, but also in public law, people normally would not expect you to make such suggestions during basic training, I would say, right? This is more or less seen as policy related, or not really purely legal in stricto sensu, right? So,
and even on that, so even in these I think we're taught much more to think about policy reasons for laws. So you do your problem question, and I thought this, actually noted this down, I thought it'd be useful to share with your audience that problem questions follow a pretty clear legal logic. So it's not just this kind of made up way of answering a question. You identify the legal issue, you identify and describe, explain the relevant law, which bits of law you've chosen, the statute, and then perhaps cases to supplement that. And then you go through the evaluation and you argue about, you know, weighing the arguments for each side about whether or not the how that law applies to those facts. And then you give an outcome, which is saying my conclusion on the facts, or the judge would be likely to conclude that the first element of the test is met, the second one isn't, the third one therefore is irrelevant, but you know, then you conclude either that there's negligence or that there's whatever elements, the crime or the public law doctrine, or whether or not there's a contract that's legally valid. So you get to the outcome there. And then at the point afterwards, you might, in your conclusion, consider the policy justifications for that answer, or whether or not it's a good answer. Mm-hmm. So you might say, for example, if it was a case of undue influence in contract law or in equity, which we won't get into, whole different part of the common law. It's very, a whole different set of legal origins and doctrines. Yeah. Not legal pluralism, but quite hard to describe. So then you get to this point where you say, well, the person, this person was unjustly enriched or something, or this person didn't properly consent to the contract because they were incapacitated and they thought they had legal advice, but the legal advice was insufficient, or because the lawyer who advised them was had a conflict of interest or something. And so you might say, well, here's the outcome on the law, but that outcome is an unjust outcome. And therefore, perhaps we should make an argument that that minority decision, which I discussed in my law and evaluation section, should actually apply. So I'll ask the judge in this case to evolve the law in this way, or to amend it to the circumstances to avoid an injustice or something overly disproportionate or something. Something like that. So there's all of these policy principles in which we might assess even our problem questions.
And Rebecca, when it comes to your specific course, because I found it specifically interesting, obviously, that you were teaching quite the same subject that I'm teaching, which is about legal research and legal writing. How does that fit into the picture? So what are you doing with, or what have you been doing with the students there? And what was the purpose of this within the framework of legal education?
Sure, absolutely. So within the framework of legal education, the first year of law school isn't really at law school. It's just a first year entry level that's open to most students. And you have to pass some quite competitive exams at the end of first year to get into second year. From second year, you start doing compulsory subjects of contract, tort, criminal law, equity, property, public law, ethics. And now tikanga, which is new as of this year. So that's that first law I talked about at the beginning. And then the different law schools get to choose where they want to put this legal research and writing course. And some of them, my old university used to put it at the beginning or in that second year when you first go to law school. Other universities put it later on, which I think has utility, because by the time you're doing your own independent legal research later on in your 3, 4, 5 year degree, you might want those, a reminder of those skills later. But our university would teach it earlier because they said, we are in this course going to teach you legal skills to determine which sources you can rely on or not, and why to find them, and then legal writing skills, where you will pretty routinely apply this claim law evaluation outcome that I described before. So in terms of assessments, we would have some geared at research. I think the first one's geared at writing. The second one is geared at, now you do your own research and we focus much more on what your research is. And then the third one is, now we want you to write in the style of what we just described with your own research that you've already done from the last one. So it's kind of this cumulatively building skill-based exercise. And in terms of the legal research, most of it, I mentioned in Austria as well, is online now. And so we really try and teach students, and there's just an abundance of material. So we really try and teach students how to hone in on which material is relevant, on which things are authoritative, when looking at cases, how to decide if they're going to be persuasive or not, how to find useful secondary sources, how to footnote mine, for example, or follow particular search strings, or go from the primary source and find all of the secondary sources that are linked to that, or find a useful secondary source on the topic and then figure out how to find the most relevant cases or prime resources through that. Mm-hmm. So that's illegal research, and we teach it in quite small groups. So there's groups of only about 16 people in each class, and every week they have homework, more homework in New Zealand education. They come to class, and there are even computer lab mm-hmm. weeks that we do together where we'll say, okay, get into pairs, and one of you is going to run this. You're supposed to try and find this thing. And, oh, look, you didn't find it, and said you found 700 results. Okay, talk with your partner. How can you narrow that down to find exactly what I'm asking you to find? Or vice versa, I'm asking you to find, I don't have an end goal in mind, but I would like you to find relevant things on this topic. And so how are you going to learn how to navigate the legal databases, online databases to do that? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's illegal research. I'll let you jump in if you have any questions on that.
I'm just asking, my question would be, who's teaching this? Is it senior staff? Is it juniors? Is it both? Or how is this split?
Yeah, so usually it's junior staff. People who've graduated, and maybe they're working in top tier law firms or something at the beginning of their graduate career. But there's also a more senior staff member as well, maybe not quite a professor, but someone of that similar to that level, where they run a couple of lectures at the beginning of the entire course. So they do some very general overview things about how we might assess sources for reliability, or they might say, here's an overview, remember how our legal system works. You're going to be needing to find things that deal with statute law, things that deal with case law, things that deal with tikanga, things that deal with comparative law. So we end up also doing quite a lot of comparative legal research, which we try and teach them in this course as well, which is difficult because they're just trying to understand New Zealand law for kind of the first time they've themselves engaged with it, as opposed to it being taught to them in the first year.
And comparative law mainly means then Australia and UK, or
yeah,
could it also
mainly,
be okay.
Mainly Australia, UK, Canada often as well, occasionally the US. Those are the main ones. But then you
Isn't
also
it
have this
very, very difficult then for the teacher to stay up to date where to find all this additional material on a daily basis when the whole infrastructure is moving so quickly due to digitalization as it's moving at the moment?
Yes,
so how
it
do
absolutely
you keep
is.
Yourself up to date? I mean, I don't have any clue about Canadian databases is, or I don't know,
yeah,
New Zealand databases is, and how they change.
If you have a good research librarian, then you ask them to be on all of the newsletter links or something. So you might. So when I was practicing law, I would get kind of digests or summaries of cases that have been heard around the world in final appellate courts in the Commonwealth. And I might scroll through and think, okay, I'm practicing public law at the moment, so I don't need to find out about criminal law, contract law, company law. And I scroll down until I get to the public law heading, and then I see that the UK Supreme Court has made this decision on judicial review, and the Canada Supreme Court has made this decision on charter freedoms, or so that's one way of doing it. The other way is to, I guess you probably maybe do attend more legal education seminars in your workplace or something.
I don't think so. I think it would be rather, I mean, it's absolutely uncommon for an Austrian lawyer to look into what the Spanish Supreme Court decided last week, or the French Cour Constitutionnel has to deal with at the moment, right? You are very, very much dealing with your own national law. You constantly look to Germany. I mean, this is something everyone is doing, right? So let's see how the Germans are doing this. And sometimes perhaps also Switzerland is of relevance, but when it comes to, Spain or France or Greece, I mean, there's already the language barrier, obviously, that makes things more difficult. But it's also the question of legal. I mean, what students are supposed to consider as being important, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah, so most students wouldn't be engaging with a lot of comparative research, but at this point in the course, because it's the only chance we get to teach them legal research, we will say, here's how to find the United Kingdom Supreme Court cases. And it's also, I guess I should say here, that it's not done uncritically. It's it's done on a pretty firm critical analysis of whether or not our law is sufficiently similar to that law. So it might be that we have the exact same legislative provision, in which case we'll look at their law. But if we don't have the same legislative provision, then it really reduces the persuasiveness of any cases on the matter.
Yeah,
I guess unless they're a common law case and there's leftover areas of like agency, contractual agency or something is not covered by statute. So that's very difficult and shouldn't be a problem for second year law students. But.
I see. And then when it comes to the writing part, so students have done the research and then they're supposed to put this into a certain format when writing the argument, correct?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And that's where we teach them this claim law evaluation outcome and get them to try and critically in their practice. And so we'll do this in class and have arguments about it in class, as well as then they go away and write it in their assignments. Again, on like a... where, so this is very interesting, actually, and it kind of demonstrates this casebook style that I was referring to before. We have a lot of hypothetical cases, and we see, well, given what we know about the statute and given what we know about other cases, how would we argue the answer to this case, or how would we how would this case be resolved or this issue be resolved? And in the course that I was teaching, we would actually have one set of facts for all of the classes and one set of facts for all of the assessments. So through class, they're doing legal research on this fact scenario and then learning at each week a different stage of the legal analysis writing for the fact scenario that we're dealing with in class. But the one that we're doing in our assignments is going to be the same one running through, but different to the one that we're doing in class. So hopefully there they're learning to... and I think the reason why we do that is that you can extrapolate the skills. And if you can't extrapolate the skills that you're learning into your assessment, then we would think you probably haven't learned how to do that yet. Or you don't understand what the law is, because it's actually analogous. There's a good analogy here, but you haven't picked up on that. So
it's not only about the technical part of how to build up your argument, it's also about understanding what the content really says, right? So it's a mixture between formal and material.
It's a mixture between, the problem with this course, well, not the problem, but the problem with doing it in the second year of your five-year degree is that you haven't yet done any of the compulsory courses. So you have to choose, so as teachers and examiners, you have to choose topics that nobody will be unfairly advantaged because they're covering them in their class, whereas not everybody takes the same compulsory courses at the same time. So you don't want to choose a negligence problem, for example, because some of the students will be doing torts and some of them won't be doing torts. And so you have to choose things like... relationship property, or what happens to somebody's will, or consumer protection law, or some other type of law that they have no idea about. So we do definitely try and strip it back and say, this is a course for skill learning. Your mastery of the very niche part of this law is obviously going to become, you're going to learn how to do that. And if you have managed to master it, then we assume that your legal research is exactly on the right track and that your legal writing, you've learned that skill. But we don't really care actually what you get to on the answer of relationship property law or something else. We're really just using them as working through methods for them to learn the skills and practice them in different contexts so that then they can go away and do them in their compulsory courses and in their elective courses later on.
Yeah. And how difficult is it to pass?
I don't think it's as difficult as in Austria, actually, to be honest.
Okay. Okay. So it's, but I mean, if you compare it with, I don't know, equity or torts or something, is this taken equally seriously by students or is it just a nice to have?
No, it's taken equally seriously. Frustratingly for many students, the course isn't worth as much as those courses. And so they don't think they should dedicate their requisite time to it, and I think they're talking about changing the weighting of the course, but it's It's still quite important, for example, if you want to do advanced legal studies or do your honours degree, then that mark plays into whether or not you're eligible to apply for those kinds okay. of programs.
So it's important to be to invest sufficient amounts of time and
it is important. And I'd say the pass rates are probably about the same as the other compulsory courses.
Okay. Okay, and when it comes to the prestige for the teachers, is this equivalent to equity or torts, or is it something people like less because it's technical?
That's a good question. I think the main difference in terms of the teachers is that we teach it as a very, this is the most practical course that is taught. It's a bit like the exercises here, except there's only 16 people in a room. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I would teach that class 3 times a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll mark the assessments of 60 students or something. But then because the cohort of law students is still going to be around 300, 350 students that are allowed into law school each year,
mm-hmm.
That means you need a lot of people to teach it. And no professional academic wants to spend their entire time,
yeah.
right? Because it takes up the entire week. Every hour of the week is basically accounted for in terms of this teaching.
Yeah.
So that's just not something that a senior academic can realistically do. And that's mm-hmm. why it's taught by junior, by graduate students who would like, I think, to become academics in the future, or they're interested in that, or they're keeping it open, or maybe they care a lot about legal writing and research.
Mm-hmm.
I was in both of those camps where I said, I really care about legal research and writing. I really like working with young people. I'm interested in an academic career. This seems like a good choice for me to sign up for. But so it's not really taught in a very different way to lots of the other classes, which would have a professor teaching the class, the lecturing, but in this more Socratic style, the class. Mm-hmm. For 3 hours a week, and the class might be 100 to 300 students. And then if it's one of those compulsory courses that I talked about, criminal law, contract, torts, public, then they would have a small group seminar, which is taught by an undergraduate student.
So even then,
they have quite a lot of practical engagement with thinking about how to apply the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the main things I've realized in my teaching experience at the University of Vienna, because at the University of Vienna, I think the focus is on ensuring students know what the law is,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously the focus of law school, right? Learn what the law is. But my New Zealand legal tradition is and learn how to apply it. Mm-hmm. And so in my course last semester, I said, right, we're going to spend 2/3 of the course of the exam saying, learn, tell me what the law is, and 1/3 of it applying the law. And the pass rates for that were dramatically different.
Okay.
Because okay. I think the legal culture is quite different. The aim of law school is quite different. The aim of law school, from my experience of teaching that course, is that we get a whole lot of people who have a lot of knowledge.
Mm.
But you're not necessarily teaching them to be lawyers, I'm not sure. But in New Zealand, it's very practical. We have a much, don't want to say this without offending New Zealanders, but we don't have a culture of strong higher education.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't that many people doing their PhDs. Whereas in Vienna, I run into them in my running club, in this place, mm-hmm. in that place. Mm-hmm. It's considered still to be part of your legal training.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't do a master's, people would also say, oh, why didn't you do a master's? But in New Zealand, we don't have that commitment to tertiary education that Austria does, which is, I think, why the legal education in the law degree is very practical. So you have to learn how to apply it, because that's probably what you're going to be doing, is applying the law. And you're probably not going to go on to academia. So we're not going to focus just on what your knowledge of what the law is. I think that's one of the differences.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I didn't mean to offend my students either for not understanding that or anybody else.
I I would have loved to see that, how students react on this, by the way. So the Austrian students, I mean. Just one question, if I may, to close this. Is there a second stage of such a class for students who want to write a PhD or a similar academic endeavor? So is there some kind of follow-up of legal writing when it comes to scientific debates, or is this something that people need to learn on the job then?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think there should be more of it. It's more than something people learn on the job. So if you end up doing a more research-heavy job, so maybe you leave law school and you've graduated and you go in and practice criminal law in the district court. Mm-hmm. That's when you get that common assault, robbery. You're probably not going to need to do a lot of legal research there. And your writing needs to be clear and very simple and very fast. Whereas if you go into a different job, like I went into working at the Supreme Court, which is a very research-heavy job, and then there's a specialist librarian there, and the librarian can help you, and you'll get in training from LexisNexis and Thomas... Mm-hmm. What's it called? Luke Westlaw, whatever the other version of it is called. So if you're working in a big firm or you're working in the courts, you'll be given a lot of extra training on the job, but legal research training, legal writing training, but more in kind of a professional context. Although I think it would be very helpful to have that course either rerun kind of at the end of your law degree before you're ready to go off and do more of your own work, because once you start working, whether in academia or in practice, all of your research is your own research, right? So the partner comes to you and says, here's my client's problem. And you have to then figure out, where do I go to start to find the law on that problem? Mm-hmm. So I think there should be more of it, absolutely. I think it'd be very helpful if we taught more or repeated this learning process later. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, they do kind of do it again for honors students. You can access more of the librarians. It's your law degree turns into a law degree specializing in legal research and independent legal research, but not for everybody else. And I think it would be helpful.
Okay, that's perhaps something that we have in common in Austria and in New Zealand, that a little bit more of this might be helpful for many more people. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us here. It was really a pleasure to learn from you. Thank you so much. And have a wonderful afternoon. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye. Bye-bye.